Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are the head of Democracy 21 and legal expert Fred Wertheimer and Hollywood screenwriter and political consultant Billy Ray. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom at gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Real Paper and ExpressVPN, and our episode show notes. We really thank you for supporting our sponsors because it helps make this podcast happen. Now please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. It appears the House, finally, over the objections of the Republicans' pro-Putin contingent, is going to vote, it seems, on the outnumbered Ukrainian assistance for them as it struggles against the Russian invasion. It's going badly. The assistance, which, by the way, involves a big chunk of money for domestic defense production, should have been sent months ago. It should pass if they bring it to a vote with almost all Democratic votes. The temptation in Washington circles is to say, hey, three cheers for House Speaker Mike Johnson for bringing this to the floor at the risk of the crazies moving to unseat him. Well, I'll say one cheer. As Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill says, he's better than Kevin McCarthy, but that's a very low bar. You know, this is something, a vote. You bring a vote to the floor if it's a big issue. That's what you do. And he has to deal with these crazy Republicans. And it's not worth being Speaker if you can't do that. I think it's really remarkable when you look at these people. This is a life or death issue for the Ukrainians. And if the Russians were victorious, it would be terrible for Europe, terrible for the United States, terrible for our credibility. And as for those right-wing Republicans who oppose aid to Ukraine, they say, well, it's not worth it because it's a lot of money and too difficult. But they're all for aid to Israel, which I am too, to counter the threat of Iran. And they're all for aid to Taiwan, which I am too, to counter China. They don't see Russia as a threat. You know, not just the Ukrainians, but ask the Lithuanians or the Estonians or the Poles or Finland. Hey James, what is it about Putin?
Well, first of all, there was a story, I'm sure it was accurate, about they can't stand Iran. Putin is supplying Iran with all this technology and weaponry. So it's so massively, it's not inconsistent or hypocritical, it's something beyond that. And I'm just going to say right now what I really think. I think that there's a lot of Russian money in Republican politics in the United States. And how are they so pro-anti-Iran and pro-Russian when you look at the relationship between Russia and Iran? It defies all stupidity. In terms of Mike Johnson, no one has been as critical of Mike Johnson and his background as I have. I'd give him maybe not three cheers, but a little more than one and a half. And if he gets this Ukraine through, I'll give him two cheers. I mean, it's the best you can do under the circumstances. They got a two-vote majority. Huge parts of their caucus is nutty in a fruitcake. And Johnson might be, I don't want to say it right now, one of these people that come along in American history that just punch above their weight. Now, he didn't have much weight to start with, but I'm in the process of reevaluating the speakership of one Mike Johnson, and let's see if he gets this through, but he might be better than we thought. That's what I'll leave.
Well, I agree with Mikey Sherrill. It's an awful low bar. You know, maybe he's a welterweight, probably more like a flyweight. I mean, again, this is just bringing to the floor a vote on a very important matter. Not, you know, voting for it, voting against it. And if you can't bring a measure to the floor that's that has some urgency to it, you shouldn't be Speaker. And I'm glad it's better than not bringing it. If he hadn't brought it to the floor and Ukraine had been defeated in the next 6 or 9 months, a great likelihood, he would have gone down as one of the most disgraceful speakers in American history.
Right.
So
I'm going to stick with my evaluation. And remember, Hassett, somehow or another we forget Dennis Hassett. Whatever happened to that guy? Huh? He went to jail.
He was a pervert.
All right? They had the Hassett rule. Under the Hassett rule, you couldn't bring this up because you'd have had to have a majority of the majority. So he's actually, I know it's his job and everything else, but he's going against a solid, I don't know if it's probably a majority of his caucus. I give him one more credit. I mean, I think it might confuse him with Nancy Pelosi or Sam Reagan
or John Boehner.
But under the circumstances, he's as good as you
well,
can get.
Well, I wouldn't quarrel with that. It's just not, you can't get much. The other issue is of course, Israel. And I keep reading that, of course, Israel has to respond to the Iranian massive drone attacks. Those were thwarted with the help of important allies, both the United States, Europe, and also in the region. So I guess I'm kind of asking, why is it, of course, they have to respond? They managed to take out an important Iranian Revolutionary Guard high official in Damascus. Iran tried to respond. It failed. I know. Was there one casualty at most? Why not declare victory? I think this should be a golden moment for Netanyahu. Being Netanyahu, I doubt he'll seize it. But this an escalation of this conflict for Israel, catastrophic for its standing in the world, catastrophic for the region, and probably doom Joe Biden's reelection. I just don't buy into the narrative that, of course, Israel has to respond. They're winning.
Well, winning where? But if you go back to the drone attack on Israel, there are considerably people pretty smart that think this was a kind of rigged deal, that the Iranians told the Israelis in the U.S. what they were going to do, when they were going to do it. You know, Biden rushes back to Washington, with the implication being he kind of knew the time they were coming. I don't know. I'm spreading salacious gossip, but I got to tell you, there's a lot of high-end gossip that says that this was a kind of Iran had to do something. They didn't want to start a war.
Yeah,
and everybody,
I think that's more than high-end gossip.
I have no hardcore proof that's true, but it doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, I think when I say Israel's winning, they're winning in this exchange. They got what they wanted in wiping out one of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And the response, not only was it ineffective, but it really was an incredibly powerful signal, I think, that Israel has important allies and that whether it's the Iron Dome or the American ships and the Jordanians and the Saudis, it was really damn effective in this exchange Israel won. And I think they ought to declare a victory and move on.
I saw one of the generals was on there. And these drones fly at the speed of a Piper Cub. I think you could take one of these things out with an assault weapon, maybe, but I don't know that. But it was good. I mean, nothing got through. It was
I think it's true, James.
Repeat the rumor.
I think it's a pretty verified rumor. And you look at the circumstances, it was clear for days they were going to do it and how they did it. I
wish somebody would ask one of these right wingers, what do they think about Russian involvement helping Iran?
Well, why don't you get J.D. Vance on this program?
I think that's
and then we can ask
story.
Him. J.D., huh?
Right away. He ain't gonna stop the Jackson.
Well, anyway, I cannot tell you how frightening it is if this conflict were to escalate. I think it's time to work towards a solution, and I think it's time that the Israelis realize they wiped out a lot of people. They've cost themselves. They've won in Gaza, whatever winning means, but they've cost themselves a lot, and now's the time to, you know, look at the future. I don't think Bibi will do that, but that's what they ought to do.
If you ask the question, was Israel better off on October 6th of 2023 than it is today, the answer is demonstratively yes.
I agree.
No one can underestimate the depth of the Israeli negligence in the events of October 7th. A lot of this was brought upon as a result of Benjamin Netanyahu's gross, I would say, I mean, some things should be so negligent, they're criminal. I think Netanyahu, what Israeli law is, but if they have a statute on criminal negligence, they ought to bring charges against him. He was that negligent.
Well, and of course, he's going to keep this thing going because he has other charges brought against him. He wants to stay out of jail. And that's not in the interest of the Israelis or obviously the Palestinians or the region or the United States. But he's Benjamin Netanyahu. That's just sad. James, let's come home. For all the problems the Democrats have, and we've noted those, maybe it's worse for Republicans. A few weeks ago, was one of the three or four Biden states that the GOP was fairly confident they were going to win back. Then, as we discussed last week, the Republican state Supreme Court reinstated that 1864 law banning all abortions. But what's so interesting this week is Republicans are in a state of panic. Carrie Lake, the MAGA-loving U.S. Senate candidate, did a 180 on her support for that 1864 act. No more. We have to fix it. Governor Doug Ducey, who appointed most of those Supreme Court justices, says, well, that's not what I intended them to do. And most Republicans in the state legislature, where they only have a two-vote margin in both in the Senate and the House, say, you know, let's repeal the 1864 law. But they are genuine right-to-lifers who really believe it, who are standing in the way. And they don't know what they would replace it with. Remember the former Attorney General and Mayor of Phoenix, who was so great in our program about that referendum he put on campaign finance disclosure? And he says he is totally confident that the pro-choice forces are going to get a referendum in November on the ballot on abortion that would basically reinstate Roe protections up to viability. And I think that's take out your coloring book, folks, and redraw the Grand Canyon state from purple tilting red to purple, probably tilting blue.
Well, certainly the Cook Report just moved the Senate race from toss up to lean down.
And a House race, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And we won two specials in Michigan, but about which they're a little bit better than Biden did in both of these legislative districts. And we're both Democratic districts, so we're going to win them. A little overperform. I don't know what it means, but it means we're not losing elections for sure. What Dobbs has done is expose the massive, and what I'm going to say, massive hypocrisy of the pro-life moment. Now, what people believed, and I kind of believed, is some of these people all really believe that abortion is murder. I don't agree with this. I don't agree with them, but they come to it from a place of conviction. And they're just all throwing their guns in it. The Catholic Church is so massively hypocritical and so controlled by the right-wing donors that Wynton Gregory, the bishop, the cardinal archbishop of the Washington diocese, went out and attacked Biden's position on abortion. So the new Glenn Youngkin, Donald Trump, everybody's new default position is 15 weeks. Well, that's a pro-choice position. Actually, Roe guaranteed the constitutional right to abortion through the first trimester, which is actually 12 weeks. So I can't tell you the number of sermons and the righteous indignation at the murder, the slaughter of innocents, that you can't imagine it. And then, okay, act like it. And then it happens, say, oh, well, no. I like 15, maybe 16. That's a good number. Maybe we'll have some exceptions. Well, think, what did you do with all the money you raised and all of the righteous indignation and the acid amnesty and abortion? Remember that? It goes back forever. They've used this.
Amnesty, too.
Right. They've used this and used it, and now they're exposed. They're showing what they all were hypocrites in the first place. The U.S. Conference of Bishops, the whole thing, they're just the massive hypocrisy. And so they, these rich Catholic donors like Trump, so they don't mention his staggering reversal on the entire issue, because no one, I mean, I think Trump, no one thinks that he thinks anything's wrong with abortion, anything else. I mean, come on. But there's some people that we actually believe that really thought this. Now we find out there are not very many.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's a, you know, it's a, I've heard some conservative pundits say, well, it won't be a voting issue in the presidential campaign. First of all, it will be. But secondly, what it does is it brings out Democrats who might not otherwise vote. Young voters of color, Latinos, who are much more pro-choice than commonly supposed. And it's going to have that effect. It has in every place it's been tested. And there's no reason to think it won't happen again in November.
The understated value of this is, it shows how far they're willing to go. So it bleeds out in a larger extent from the abortion issue to just the crazy capture of their party. So it certainly is going to help. It can't, you can't say it hadn't helped. We don't lose any freaking elections anymore.
No, I agree. Hey, James, give me a point of personal privilege, a final note about my wife, Judy Woodruff's colleague and mentor, Robin McNeil, who passed away this week at age 93. He was an extraordinary American journalist, author of memoirs, novels, and a book on the English language. He was a native Canadian who became an American citizen. In 1983, he and Jim Lehrer started what is now called the PBS NewsHour, America's first hour-long show. I was around back then. There were many, many skeptics. It's just not going to make it. It's still flourishing after 40 years. That's a great testament to these two remarkable journalists, Jim and Robin McNeil.
Yeah, concur wholeheartedly. I knew him not very well, but he was an iconic figure in, you know, modern journalism, to say the least.
He was a stiff because he was very proper on the air. He was actually quite a charming man with a good sense of humor, and he had a great legacy.
Use products that help the planet. Pick real paper. It's important for a lot of ways. Number one, it does, in its own way, does help the planet, and it also makes you feel better about using it. And I use paper towels a lot. I mean, and they'll say, you know, did this, you know, the toilet paper not in the paper towels and paper products, and who knows where these guys are going to take this new way of doing things. But this is a terrific company and terrifically innovative, and I'm glad to see that they're expanding to other products.
Well, as believers in sustainability, commit with us to using only environmentally friendly, toxin-free, all-natural products. The kitchen is the best place to start. It's especially critical to use all-natural products when we're cleaning near our food, and so many cleaning goods come wrapped in plastic. That's why we switched to Reel's new bamboo paper towels. Like all Reel's products, their paper towels are free of inks, dyes, BPA, and 100% tree-free. All Reel's packaging is plastic-free, even the box tape. Other so-called sustainable paper towels, they just don't cut it. They're flimsy, unabsorbent, and rough, just like the cheap paper towels in public restrooms. Reel's new bamboo paper towels are the first truly premium, sustainable option. They're up to 50% thicker and more absorbent than any other leading brands and have 2-ply sheets. Reel handles the toughest messes, can soak up anything, and never fall apart on me. Now, or me, or James, or any of you. Now, Reel Paper is the only brand to use in your home and kitchens. Now remember, Reel Paper's packaging is plastic-free, compostable, and all orders ship-free. So ditch those tree-based options wrapped in plastic. Reel even partners with One Tree Planting, so with every box of Reel that you buy, they are funding reforestation efforts across the country. Other paper towels cut down trees. Reel actually actively helps plant them. Make the switch. Reel Paper is available in easy, hassle-free subscriptions or for one-time purchases on their website. All orders are conveniently delivered to your door with free shipping and 100% recyclable, plastic-free packaging. If you head to realpaper.com/war room, and sign up for a subscription using our code WARROOM at checkout, you'll automatically get 30% off your first order and free shipping. That's REELPAPER.com/WARROOM or enter promo code WARROOM to get 30% off your first order plus free shipping. So let's give Reels tree-free paper a try. Reel is a paper for the planet. Find the link, by the way, in our show notes. Hey, James, our guest is Fred Wertheimer, the head of Democracy 21, who for 50 years has fought against the influence of money in politics and corruption. And I've been with him the whole time, at least writing about it with him. He's actively involved in the criminal cases against Donald Trump, including participating in several briefs. Fred, the Manhattan case, the first criminal trial of a former president in American history, has been dismissed by some critics as really the weakest of the case, just paying off a mistress. You have argued it's much more than that. Could you explain?
Sure. It isn't the strongest case, but it's a very important case. And there's been a lot of confusion about what the case is about. It's often described in the media as a hush money case. This is what the judge said about the case. Quote, I'm quoting, "The allegations are in substance that Donald Trump falsified business records to conceal an agreement with others to unlawfully influence the 2016 presidential election." And that's what this case is about. That's what the prosecution is out to try to establish. And if they do, this is a felony case. He's charged with 34 felonies in this case. It is by no means unimportant. And you can see by his performance at the trial so far that he doesn't consider it unimportant.
Because basically what it is he gave, tell me what I get wrong here. I think I get most of it right. He enlisted Michael Cohen, that's a clear fact, to pay off Stormy Daniels, someone who he allegedly had an affair with, and who was going to go public with it in mid-October of 2016, because they thought after the Access Hollywood tape, if that came out, it might really doom his candidacy, you know, finally. And then they cooked the books to hide that disclosure. Is that basically the case? Am I missing anything?
Yeah, no, that is basically the case. And we have to remember the context, as you pointed out. There was a huge firestorm after the Access Hollywood tapes was shown on television. And this payment took place after that firestorm and just 12 days before the election. So the prosecution is going to have to establish here that his purpose was to prevent this information from influencing the election. He argues that, well, he only paid the money in order to prevent his wife from hearing about this. Although he then raises questions about what he actually did. He also argues that he had nothing to do with the way the books were prepared. Some accountant did it. Some lawyer did it. Now, the interesting thing is he claims he's going to testify, but it's very unlikely that he will. And if he doesn't, it becomes more complicated for him to get these positions in as evidence. So this trial is moving quicker than anyone expected. They now expect to have a jury by the end of this week and to start the trial next Monday. And it's a one-of-a-kind trial. We've never had a trial for a former president, a criminal trial.
as a layperson, I have no doubt Trump did it. I have no doubt that he commissioned the payoff. No doubt that it was done for political reasons. I mean, the idea that he didn't want his wife, as if his wife thought he was St. Francis of Assisi before October of 2016. And no doubt that they wouldn't have cooked the books without his knowledge. But a couple of things give me a little pause. So I want you to address them. A really good, tough prosecutor, Mark Pine, is counsel to that DA's office while saying Trump clearly committed crimes, but he lacked confidence in Alvin Bragg, the DA. And then the Southern District sent Michael Cohen, the Trump's fixer, on these similar counts. They convicted him, sent him to jail. They chose not to indict Trump. Why shouldn't both of those realities give me pause?
Well, keep in mind that they chose not to indict Trump under a Trump administration. And the then U.S. Attorney for the Southern District has written a book in which he claims that they interfered with what the Southern District in New York was doing all of the time. And I can't give Mark Pomerantz too much credit when he left the office and went out and wrote a book, which was highly unethical to do, having been an attorney on that case. But be that as it may, the case is there. The facts are going to be there. Bragg has been pretty forceful in going forward. This is a very strong judge. He's not taking anything from Trump or anyone else. The difficulty in my mind in this case is the following. The prosecution needs to get 12 out of 12 jurors in order to convict him. Trump needs to get only one juror to get a hung jury here. And that's pretty difficult to do. Now, criminal cases have convictions all the time, but we don't know who the 12 jurors are. And if he gets a hung jury, he's not going to get acquitted. I do not believe you get 12 jurors to say he was innocent of everything he did. But if he just gets one, it's a hung jury. And then it's very unlikely that this, even if it's retried, that it will take place before the election. And yeah. Trump's efforts all along have been to postpone all of these cases until after the election.
Yeah, people say that Manhattan is, 87% Republican. That's one out of 12. And that's all you need. But anyway, James Carville.
So, Fred, if I gave you an even money bet that this judge locks Trump up for contempt before the trial ends, what side would you take?
I would say no.
No?
I would say no because Trump wants to be locked up and play, you know, Trump's letter from the Manhattan jail. He's already compared himself to Mandela. Absent his 27 years in jail. And I think the judge knows what's going on. What the judge may do is really pressure the lawyers. He's already threatened to put him in jail as a possibility. I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, you know, anybody's limits could get tested. So I think opening arguments, are they going to be Monday?
I think they could be. No one knows, but they could be. Monday.
Opening arguments are maybe the most interesting and revelatory thing in any criminal trial, because the state is going to tell the jury what they're getting ready to prove. And you can see in who is going to come forward to prove this. And they're going to say, you will hear that this was done because of Trump obviously didn't want his wife to know about this. It's really not any about business. And that was the motivation. I think when they got Hope Hicks and David Pecker and accountant And people like that are going to come in and testify as to his state of mind. And I think that the prosecution is going to lay that out in open argument. Defense is going to tell you what their defense is going to be. And you're a better lawyer than I was, for sure. But it's when you make an opening statement, if you don't prove what you told the jury that you're going to prove, they hold it against you. And, mm-hmm. and do you agree that these opening statements are going to give us a good purview of what we're going to hear in the weeks coming during this trial?
I totally agree. They're going to, each side's going to lay out their best
right.
case for first impressions.
Right. And it's going to be, you know, we all assume their defense is going to be for his wife not do it. We're going to get a good look at their defense, and we're going to get a good look at, you know, what the prosecution says they're going to prove, and they're going to address the point that it was he didn't want to be embarrassed by it. So that's going to be fascinating, I believe.
You mentioned a very interesting player here, David Pecker.
Right.
David Pecker was the owner of National Enquirer. National Enquirer paid off a second woman,
Karen McDougal.
Who's
going to testify?
His company entered into an agreement with the Southern District of New York that states that she was paid off in order to stop this, that the principal, I'll read it to you, the principal purpose of payment was to suppress the woman's story so as to prevent it from influencing the election. That is the key issue in question here in terms of the reason that that Stormy Daniels was paid off. And if she or someone or Pecker testifies to that, it's going to be pretty strong evidence of what was going on at that time.
Absolutely. I'll wait and see. I have expectations. Mm-hmm. But my expectation is after opening arguments, the people that claim this is a kind of weak hush money case are going to sort of come around and say, now, this thing might be a little bit more than I thought. But that's my... My general view. I want to get your political expertise here. We were having a discussion about Mike Johnson and his speakership. And we're both a little bit more than out. This guy's turned out to be a little better than we thought he could be. Do you agree with that?
Yes, but I don't like giving political expertise, so-called, to you two guys, and that's a very dangerous path for me to walk down. Yes, I do it, but not in public.
Right.
The thing that's happened with him is he's realized what the job is. You know, he's got huge responsibilities here. So as a member of the House, he probably would have had nothing to do with preventing the government from being shut down.
Right.
As Speaker, he did the job. He did his part to make sure the government wasn't shut down. And now he's going through an interesting exercise. It's very hard to know what's... I mean, I think hit the threats of him to him, people are playing with no cards. Because they really cannot and will not remove him, even if they try. But his first audience is the Republican Conference. And, you know, he's taken one step back. He hasn't come out with his foreign aid bill today yet, which he was supposed to do in order for the House to vote on it on Friday.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Fred, let me take you back to the Trump trials. You followed all four indictments.
Sure.
January 6th, I think we agree, is the most serious. Trump in Georgia, Trump is on tape trying to fix the election, post-election. His former Attorney General William Barr says the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case is the strongest. How has he managed to delay all of these cases until after the election?
Well, he's had some help. The judge in Florida, this case, has been overturned twice already by the 11th Circuit for what appeared to be clear biased positions she's taken for Trump. She's created the appearance of bias, and she's has lots of discretion to delay this. The Georgia case got caught up in the DA's relationship with the person she hired, the man she hired to oversee the case for her, and caused all kinds of appearance questions. And so far, they've had some cooperation from the Supreme Court in the January 6th case.
So, Fred, the January 6th case, where he's making this jump, is that he basically has immunity from committing a crime. Do you think Republicans on the Supreme Court are slow walking this case?
We'll find out. In very important cases in the past, there's been very little difference between the time of oral argument and the decision coming out. And I'm writing a piece on that right now. If they get into June, and mid-June, late June, if they don't do this in May, then it becomes very suspicious that at least some of the Republicans are slow walking it. They had a chance last December to take this case right away, and they did not do that.
Fred, you mentioned that judge who's mentioned the Mar-a-Lago case, Federalist Society, Trump-appointed judge. There's some speculation she could just throw the case out. Is there any recourse if she tries to do that?
Yeah, you can appeal it. There is no recourse if she starts the case, has a jury impaneled, and in the middle of the case goes to dismiss it. At that point, double jeopardy has set in, and there's no appeal. But right now, there's no evidence that she's going to move on this case. And if she holds it past the election and Trump wins, Trump gets the case dismissed, and she doesn't have to do any more than just slow walk it. Very slow walk.
Let me try one more involving the Supreme Court. They heard arguments this week over the central charge against the January 6th insurrectionist. Does that mean all the January 6th criminals go free?
No, it does not, because a number of the January 6th criminals were charged with other things beside this provision. But it will depend on how they write a decision here as to what would happen with those who were just charged with this obstruction count. In theory, and those people could go free if they basically argue that the provision did not apply to them. They, in theory, could be charged again on other provisions. And if these are also provisions that apply in the January 6th case, but no matter how the court rules here, there are other provisions that would stay in place for Trump. And even this provision probably would stay in place, because if it was a very narrow decision that it only dealt with obstruction over documents, you have the fake electors documents at play here. It doesn't appear that it will affect the Trump case in the same way it might affect a number of these prisoners.
Okay, James?
So I might be confusing the federal rules with the Louisiana criminal, but as I recall, at the end of the trial, both sides will ask for a direct verdict. So there's not any issue here. I think that's in the federal rules. And what you're saying is if she grants a directed verdict to the defense, there's no appeal of that.
No, I'm saying if she dismisses the case in the middle of the trial,
okay,
there's no appeal.
So she could just dismiss it and just for any reason that she wanted to.
Yeah, in the middle of the trial, they could get up and move to have the case dismissed. And if she dismisses it, you can't appeal it. That's my understanding.
Right, right. I think that's what I hear, too, but that's worthy of further examination. So Linda Greenhouse, who I have been on this program before, and I think is one of the great Supreme Court journalists of all time, she's been doing it forever, wrote, I thought, a very good piece. They're always putting out how well they get along, and Nino and Stephen Breyer with Texas Tech Law School and Lubbock, and, you know, they play gin rummy on Friday night or whatever. And her point is, who in the shit cares? What difference does it make if they're... But I think the Supreme Court puts that out to say it's all... And what I got a little beef with Brown and Sotomayor and Kagan. They go along with this nonsense. And, like, we really try to be collaborative and collegial. I can't imagine being collegial with people who want to excuse January the 6th or come up with some of these crazy-ass rulings that they come up with. But that's what they want us to believe. Do you have any view on collegiality as a good or bad thing? It don't matter.
I don't think it matters, but I also don't buy it. And particularly with this court and the extent to which they have just thrown out past precedents without blinking an eye, it's very hard to believe that either side doesn't really care and wants to go play on weekends with each other. These are incredibly important decisions that are being made that affect millions and tens of millions of lives.
Right.
And you can't ignore that in terms of your feelings about where people are coming down.
I am told rather reliably that the justice of the Arizona Supreme Court that wrote this rule about an 1874 statute of the territorial legislature, that the godfather of his child is Clarence Thomas, and that this is all Lynn and Leo, not just in the federal courts, but the state courts also. And I don't think people are at all aware of how dangerous and how radical this stuff is.
Well, it's certainly in with this Supreme Court, it's about as radical as it can be. The Arizona decision, I mean, the 1800s are having a comeback here with that Arizona decision and Comstock Act. I don't know. We'll have to just see how far they go. It'll be interesting to see how far they go in the immunity case and in the current case about the prisoners from January 6th. It was interesting. In reading the coverage of this, I saw a lot of quotes of Alito and Thomas. I didn't see any quotes of the Chief Justice, John Roberts. Now, there may well have been, and I, like most people, I didn't hear the oral argument, but he wasn't. He seemed to be sitting back, at least from the coverage of this. So we'll see where it goes. But it would be very interesting if this so-called tough-on-crime court decides that these people convicted of crimes should be let out because of their very narrow interpretation. In order to interpret this provision the way the defendants wanted it interpreted, originalism and textual and all of the stuff they professed to live by goes out the window.
Well, they certainly can use textualism, originalism to enforce the Comstock Act, which is still in the books.
Well, I'm talking about the obstruction proceeding.
Right. I have less faith than you can imagine that than not a blatantly political right-wing body, but I hope they prove it.
Well, this is a transactional court. They decide where they want to go, and then they fill in the blanks.
Right. They don't... Right, they decide the outcome, and then they find the evidence.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Albert, it's great.
Yeah, I know. Let me just go. Fred, we'll let you go. You've been wonderful. But on court members getting along, Walter Dellinger, the great Walter Dellinger, was a law clerk in the 60s for Hugo Black. You know, a great progressive judge. Douglas, another great progressive judge, really disliked each other. They really disliked each other. But you know what? The results were pretty goddamn good. I agree with James. I don't care whether they like each other or not. It's only what we see. And what we see is pretty discouraging.
Yeah. It's pretty bad.
Fred Wertheimer, you have brought light to us, as you have to me, for more than 50 years, which shows how goddamn old we both are. But
thank you
very much.
Happy to be here.
Protect your family's internet activity by getting ExpressVPN. And I can't imagine anyone would think otherwise. I mean, first of all, people communicate on a computer. They live on a computer. They have anything that you could know about somebody. You unlock the computer, you find out what it is. In addition to that, people that do this sell your data. They harvest it. They do all kinds of stuff. I mean, the risk that the citizen runs from not having some computer security is pretty big, even if you're not somebody that is well-known and they want to try to embarrass you. They can certainly make a lot of money off of you by harvesting your data and seeing what you do.
Sure can. Does it make sense that the same company who controls half of online retailing also passively eavesdrops on your private conversations at home? I think not. What about the idea that a single company controls 90% of internet searches, runs your email service, and gets to track thing you do on your smartphone? Big tech is more powerful than most countries, and they profit by exploiting your personal data. It's time to put a layer of protection between your online activity and these tech juggernauts, and that's why we use ExpressVPN. Sadly, every site you visit, video or watch, or message you send gets tracked and data mined. But when you run ExpressVPN on your device, the software hides your IP address. So ExpressVPN makes your activity harder to trace and sell to advertisers. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your internet data to keep you safe from hackers and eavesdroppers on your network. That's why ExpressVPN is rated number one by CNET, Wired, Tech Radar, and countless others. Plus, ExpressVPN is so easy to use. Just download the app on your phone or computer, tap one button, and you are protected. ExpressVPN makes us feel so much more comfortable working on public networks when we travel. So stop handing over your personal data to the big tech monopoly that mines your activity and sells your information. Protect yourself with the VPN I trust to keep us safe online. Visit expressvpn.com/warroom. That's ExpressVPN.com/warroom. That's expressvpn.com/warroom right now to learn more. Now, you also can find the link in our show notes. Hey, James, our guest is Hollywood screenwriter and political consultant Billy Ray. Billy, first, thanks for being with us. And this is really important stuff. What are you advising candidates mainly to do and not to do?
I think the votes are in the big middle. I've always believed that. And by that, I mean you have to be going after undecided independents who tend to lean conservative and tend to be cranky with the party in power. So you have to find a language to speak in that they can actually hear. What Democrats tend to do is speak in a frequency that makes a lot of sense to liberals, but that conservatives literally cannot hear. And then we're mystified why we don't get those votes in the middle.
So I try to teach the candidates and the electeds that I work with how to make an argument, how to sound less like a Democrat, and how to make an argument that an independent voter can actually hear.
Well, what's the biggest mistake that they're making? I mean, Democrats are winning elections all over the place this year. It doesn't seem like, Tom Suozzi in New York or other candidates in special elections have really suffered a lot because of the D label.
I would argue that they are running without advertising the D label too much. And my personal belief is that in any election, particularly the presidential, if you frame it as a Democrat versus a Republican, you can still lose. But if you frame it as an American versus an extremist, everybody knows which bucket they're supposed to be in. I do think there is a real drag effect that big D in certain states that matter. And I think it's because Democrats don't understand the fundamental psychology of what makes a conservative, what binds them together as a political group. And so I spent a lot of time trying to talk to them about that.
Well, doesn't the message, I mean, it varies by region, by district, by state. One of those New York challengers and Marcy Kaptur in Toledo are going to have different messages, different approaches, aren't they?
To a degree, but I think there's some core stuff that's really essential. Right now in America, in the land that we all love, 62% of Americans believe that if they make enough noise, they can make a corporation pay attention to them as a consumer, 62%. But only 4% of Americans believe that if they make enough noise, they can make their government pay attention to them as a citizen, 4%, which means that 96% of Americans do not believe that. If you are the party that is identified most closely with government, that's a problem. People need to believe that they matter. It's a fundamental human drive. We come out of the womb needing to know that we matter. If that drive goes unmet, society crumbles. That's when people walk into, Sandy Hook with an AR-15 and say, oh, I don't matter, watch this. 65% of Americans right now believe that they don't matter. And we as Democrats need to make this election not about us, but about them. We need to meet them where they are. We need to hear them. And we need to say to them, you are my mission. You're the reason I'm doing this. You matter. When they did a study of all of Trump's campaign lines from 2016, the one that was by far the most effective, the one that spiked, was I will be your voice. Meaning you're not just another vote to me. You matter. That was a spectacular lie. I mean, it couldn't have been more untrue, but it tracked. It spiked off the charts. Because people need to know that they matter to their family, to their community, to our country, and to our collective future. And Democrats need to approach the voter as if this election is about not party, but those voters.
James.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to take issue with something that you said.
I'm excited. And
yes. People tell me that, that I'm a moderate Democrat. I'm actually no such thing. I'm pretty liberal, but I'm not a leftist Democrat.
Right.
And you've insinuated that when Democrats or liberals use the coded identity language of the left, that people in the middle don't hear them. I think the opposite is true. I think they hear them very loud and very clear, and they don't like it at all.
Yes, I agree with you completely. What I mean is it doesn't persuade.
It aggravates.
There are several big lies in American politics. I think the biggest is that we are a divided country. We are not. When they put minimum wage on the ballot in Florida, it got 60%. They put it on the ballot in Arkansas, it got 62%, and in Missouri, it got 67%. This is a fundamental Democratic idea, hugely popular in states where Democrats routinely get their asses kicked. America agrees with us on choice. It agrees with us on protecting Social Security and Medicare. It agrees with us on the environment. It agrees with us on decriminalizing cannabis. It agrees with us on guns. It agrees with us on everything by 2/3. So we should be winning 2/3 of the election. But we don't, because we do shit like saying, oh no, you have to say pregnant person instead of pregnant woman. And you have to say chest feeding instead of breastfeeding. We insist that people celebrate things that they have just learned how to tolerate. And that's where we lose them. We don't lose them on issues. We lose them on the cultural bullshit.
And that's because we, I think, are speaking the wrong language and telling them what language they must use, which tells them that they don't matter. No one wants to be told how to talk.
So I think these people have a stupid idea generator. And it's just what language can we use to piss off the most people? And they're pretty good at it. They're not bad at it.
No, and I will tell you something else. I can tell you where the stupid idea generator is. Okay,
Please, I want to find it.
Okay, it is in the Harvard faculty lounge.
Okay.
Up phrases like bodily autonomy. I mean, it's just nonsense. It's insane, and it's condescending. It's insulting, and I agree with you. People do hear it. They hear it loud and clear. They just don't like it. And if you poll Americans in swing House districts after an election, you know what they'll tell you? They all tell you the same thing. And it's stunning, like how regularly this happens. They'll say to you, the Republican was an asshole, the Democrat was an elitist, and the asshole never made me feel dumb. It's that simple. It's that simple. If we can stop doing that and just run an election on the merits, America agrees with us. Overwhelmingly, even conservatives agree with us on choice because they all know that if their 20-year-old daughter gets pregnant, they want her to have options. Giving them these cultural off-ramps that allow them to believe that we are insane and that we are the bringers of chaos, when in fact, the opposite is true. And it's the most self-defeating politics in the world.
So when you do your litany of things people agree on, never forget taxing incomes above $500,000 a year. That's probably the single most consistently popular thing in all of polling.
Thank you. You're absolutely right. I mean, look, what makes a conservative psychologically? What binds them together as a political group? It's their shared fear of chaos. It's what they run on every single time and have my entire life. The 1988 Willie Horton ad said, if you vote for Michael Dukakis, a black convict on furlough is going to come murder your family. Democrats are soft on crime, chaos. Then it became after 9/11, oh, Democrats are soft on terror, chaos. Then it became Democrats are for open borders, Democrats are for burning cities, Democrats are for defunding the police, Democrats don't care if your son becomes your daughter, chaos, chaos, chaos. If you give a conservative the choice between authoritarianism and what they perceive to be chaos, they'll pick authoritarianism every time. They're doing it right in front of us, right now. And so what we must do is brand ourselves as the antidote to chaos. We're just for effective government. And we must rebrand what chaos is. Chaos is not Willie Horton. Chaos is people showing up at a polling place with AR-15s. Chaos is January 6th. Remember when there were 30 cars backed up in a hospital parking lot because Trump didn't have an answer for COVID? That's chaos. We're the people who, when the I-95 bridge collapses in Pennsylvania and everyone says it'll take a year to fix, we did it in 16 days. That's what we do. We just fix shit. We build bridges. If that's our brand, we can't lose.
I so totally agree. And they come up, I'm turning over to Al. The one expression, I call it NPR, but whatever, the two that drive me crazy, one is BIPOC. That assumes that everyone who is not a Caucasian is the same. It's the most racist thing I've ever, actually, it's patently racist on its face.
It's bananas. And I'll tell you something else, okay? If you look at the polling, black and brown voters are getting more and more conservative, okay? When Obama ran, the group of Latinos that identify as conservative favored Obama 47 to 37. That same group in 2016, Latinos who are conservative, favored Trump 67-27.
Hey, James, my outrage is going to praise your favorite journalist, Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine. We'll get to that in just a minute. Uri Berlin, veteran national public radio journalist, wrote a piece for a digital internet site called The Free Press. He denounced NPR for its left-wing bias. I am an NPR news fan and of anchors like Steve Inskeep and Michelle Martin. But for all the good journalism, there is a woke bias on culture, social issues like gay and transgender rights, faith, abortion. It's a bias that I largely share, but it is a bias. So what's wrong with Berliner's piece? It is, as your friend Mr. Chait so brilliantly documented, his lead example in that piece, which is that NPR bought in to a false story of the Trump-Russian connection in 2016. The Mueller report, Berlin charge, proved that NPR, quote, swung and missed, end quote, on this fake story. Dead wrong. The Mueller report did not exonerate Trump. All it said was it could not base against that sitting president while citing multiple examples of Russia trying to help Trump and the president. Team Trump accepting it. Campaign manager Paul Manafort sharing private polling with a Russian agent. A New York meeting between Russian agents and the Trump high command about digging up dirt on Democrats. Dirty trickster Roger Stone knowing in advance about the Russian-led leaks about Hillary Clinton and John Podesta and other Democrats. If Berliner had carefully read the Mueller report and the Senate intelligence report and sites like Just Security, he would have known whether criminal or not, the Russians colluded with Trumpites to try to affect the American presidential election. If he had done that, then he could have gone on to write a credible piece.
I agree. You know, the conclusion, I find NPR, I listen to it more than most people, and it can be really, in one sense, it's really illuminating. In the other sense, it's massively aggravating. And they, and of course they have a left-wing bias, but most people, public radio people, and most educated people do. And some of their stuff is superb. That guy that does the economic stuff for them, Terry Gross, I guess he didn't do it as much as he used to. He's probably the best book interviewers in modern U.S. history. But they're always, it's all identity all the time. They're the most identity conscious outlet that I can imagine. And I think its danger is that staffers or consultants or Democratic people listen to that and think that remotely is the real world, which of course is not, decidedly right. Not. But yes, and Jonathan Wright, Walter Dellinger was on this show, I miss him every day, who said the Mueller report was not exonerating at all. And of course, the Senate, Joint Senate Intelligence Committee documented all of the Russian contacts. But this guy is now kind of a hero with the, you know, Fox News, the sort of, I knew those bitches were called left wing. You had the guts to expose him. Well, he could have done a much better job if he'd have started with the goddamn truth. It's always bad to start out with a lie.
Yes. If he'd been a careful reporter, he could have written a good piece. Yeah. Instead, yeah. he was lazy. That's unfortunate because he had a case.
Yes, he did. But he applied the wrong facts and he came out looking like a fool. And Chait exposed his ass. And Chait is hardly an NPR sycophant.
Aren't you pleased that I praised your favorite journalist?
I am. I tell you, I don't agree with everything John Chait writes, but more than anybody else. And he does. He sits there and thinks of shit. You don't. I guess I got to spend all day thinking of stuff.
It was a powerful piece. Go ahead, James.
I don't have so much outrage, but just as you think about this election, and I want everybody to do that because I certainly have, just what a devastating thing Trump being elected would be. And it's a real possibility. And the implications of this would be so staggering to life in the United States that you couldn't believe it. And so whatever you're thinking inside, and I certainly had a lot of unpleasant thoughts about all of this, the stakes just could not be higher. They really, really couldn't. And it's, you know, if you don't think that Biden's all that great or you think he's too old, there's some probably maybe justification for some of that. But just how catastrophic a Trump administration would be. And I just can't believe I live in a country where people increasingly think that January the 6th wasn't that big a deal. It's just almost impossible to think that. It just scares the
shit out of
me. We
didn't have to read about it. We saw it. Right.
We saw it right in front of our... forget the day. Yes. They were beating the crap out of people. You know, if they would have got Mike Pence, they might have fucking hung him.
Yeah, yeah.
That mob, yeah. I mean, that mob was literally crazy. And the guy that's really kind of got tangentially tied up at Judge Royce Lambeth Court. He was a kind of, at the end of the day, he thought I was right and he left me alone. But he was a real Reagan, Texas right-wing judge by any definition of it. And he's just freaking outraged at these criminals.
He is.
Royce Lambeth ain't no left-wing guy.
No, neither is Reggie Walton, who was Bill Bennett's chief. It's James, to your point, it's amazing that Republicans' candidates get away with saying, hey, it was no big deal. It was mainly peaceful protest. It's a demonstrable lie. It's right in front of your face. It's sickening.
It's Republican voters. If they said something else, it'd lose. It's just, I'm telling you, the problem is the people. It's just 40% of the people in this country are just stupid, bad people. I'm sorry. You can't look at that thing and say, oh, it was some people that had a protest that just wanted to petition the government.
Yeah.
Come on. The J6 choir. And they'll sing at Trump's inauguration.
Marjorie Taylor Greene could dance. That's a horrifying thought. Anyway. All right, James, now we have these great questions that come in every week. Again, I want to tell you, if we don't get to it this week, please send it in next week because there's so many good ones here. David in Atlanta says, Trump is pushing Biden off center stage. It seems to me Biden receives less coverage than any president in my lifetime. If that's true, is that hurting him? Is that affecting the standing in the polls, James?
Well, I don't know how you compete with a guy on a criminal trial. I mean, it's pretty hard to get more publicity than that, isn't it? I think Biden gets covered a lot. I understand kind of where he's coming from, but for whatever reason, Trump has a knack for making news, to say the least. And I don't know, but the question is well taken, but I think the answer is right in front of us.
Drew in Cleveland, Ohio, asks, any chance George W. Bush would endorse Biden this time? Would he campaign for him? Would it make a difference? I don't have any doubt of that, and I think he may privately encourage his friends, but this is just, I mean, the Bushes are Republicans, and they're not going to turn against their party with a public endorsement, fearing, among other things, it might hurt candidates down the road. Although it's interesting, one time I had a wonderful session with George H.W. Bush and Barbara Bush, and she said that I'm the gatekeeper. Whenever people call and they want to see George, they come through me. Ted Cruz called, and I said no. So maybe he wouldn't worry as much about hurting Ted Cruz.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly not going to endorse Trump. And I think there's some possibility that he lets it be known that he's voting for Biden, but I don't know that. I mean, I said before, he'd rather be around Collar than be around Trump in every way that you can imagine. But, you know, it's got to be, for him and the Bush family, it's really amazing that they have nothing among Republicans. I mean, because Trump has just so dominated everything.
James, Luke in Fall River Mills, California, says, he starts off by saying, we're in so much trouble with RFK, AI, election interference, etc. If Trump loses, what will his merry band of deadbeat MAGAs do in response? How does the stock market respond? Will they go? I mean, Luke says, I'm really worried. Ease some of his worries, James.
Well, I'm worried. I mean, I don't know if I'm much I can Yeah, that's what that's what I'm really panicked about. And it's not, as of this moment, it's certainly not an impossibility. But it's really frightening. I can't give you any other word that better describes the way that I feel about the consequences of a potential Trump winning. And the fact that people are just willing to forget all of this is disheartening, to say the least. It's really disheartening.
Yeah. No, it sure is. I agree totally. Joe and Dubs, this is a good question. Many in law enforcement support Donald Trump for president. But Trump watched TV for 3 hours on January 6th doing nothing while dozens of Capitol police were injured, some died, defending the Capitol from his mob. Shouldn't Democrats use this to aggressively court a larger block of voters, James?
You know, I can't imagine that they could be much more aggressive than they have been. I thought the January 6th committee was masterfully done.
Mm-hmm.
And the public, by and large, just rejected it. And it just can't, the probably cultural reasons among police that they like Trump, but he's the most anti-police person you could imagine. You can't believe what a crime wave that January the 6th is. But I guess people are a product of their upbringing. I don't know. I guarantee you those cops that have been sentenced in Rankin County, Mississippi, they don't vote Democratic. I promise you that. I don't know what to extrapolate from that. But if anybody goes look at their voting history, they don't vote Democratic. I promise you.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. Carolyn in Louisville says, can things happen at the last minute, like Liz Cheney or others getting names on the ballot? I think we both agree that's not going to happen. But what October surprises should we look for, Carolyn asks.
I don't know if there's anything left that's in this world as a surprise right now. It seems pretty clear that we get a surprise every day.
Right, right.
We go back to the earlier about the RFK and the handling. I am still not convinced that RFK hurts Biden more than Trump. I kind of believe it. And a lot of people call me or send out something about the woman they named for vice president. And I'm not that interested in hurting him right now because I'm not, it may be that, come September, I see things differently, but I see him as a bigger threat to Trump than I see him as a bigger threat to Biden.
Boy, I tell you, James, it may, well, we're not sure. It may be, but when you look at most, not all, but most, when it goes from a two-way race to a three-way race, the advantage increases, or the Trump, the difference between Trump and Biden. That's not true everywhere, but it's true most places, and maybe that'll change.
Yeah, it's not a terribly well-formed opinion, but my opinion is the combination of Cornel West and Jill Stein has greater potential for damage than Bobby Kennedy. But I that's not a very grounded observation. I'm willing to change it on the course of a second, but I just think there's a whole group of people out there just, I hate the whole goddamn thing, and then none of those are going to vote for Biden. And the kookier that Kennedy is, the more I like it. If you watch that convention, they had some kind of convention in Oakland, and these people are really kooky. There's some goofy-ass people behind that guy. Wow.
Oh my God. For a guy who was actually a pretty goddamn good environmental lawyer, he has turned kooky on so many things, not just vaccines. I mean, he's got there's no conspiracy that he doesn't embrace. But Stephen in California says, how we deal with Trump demanding to debate Biden? I say no debates this fall until Trump goes on national TV acknowledging he lost the election fair and square in 2020. Stephen, I know Biden doesn't want to debate. I actually think some of the Trump people are a little bit skittish about him debating too. I think debates have become overrated. I think it would be better to have them probably than not have them. I think you're onto something. I think it would be perfectly permissible and credible for Biden to say, hey, what this country is about, what this system is about is legitimate elections. And once you acknowledge that we had a legitimate election in 2020, then we can do 24.
You know, I say, of course, we'll have debates and we'll deal with that at the proper time. And then at the proper time, see where you are. And you may feel like, hey, I need to have one. There's something that's really, that Trump is having difficulty with, and a debate might be a good place to sort of take him out on this. I don't know, but why tip your hand right now? And, you know, we're certainly open to idea, and we'll look at the proposals that are before us and from the commission, and fine. And just move on from there. And if you determine down the road it's in your interest, then you can say it's consistent with what I did. If you determine it's not in your interest, as you say, he doesn't acknowledge the election, or he told, you know, he says he lies every day, so you get an excuse to say he lied. But I don't see the value in letting Trump go all around the country saying, oh, yeah, I want a debate, you know, Biden doesn't. And, you know, to some people that hear that, that don't pay that much attention to politics, which are most people, it goes, well, you know, Biden's probably too old, blah, 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 blah. It's like, you know, Trump says he's going to testify at his trial. So why not? And by the way, if you want to know where the verdict is going, if he doesn't testify, that's probably not a good sign for the prosecution. If he actually decides to testify, it will only mean one thing, that the lawyers have concluded there was an overwhelming chance that he'd be found guilty and they had to put him out there. It's going to tip his hand. But there's no need to take a position right now. Oh, yeah, sure, Corbin. We'll look at it.
Yeah. James, you're going to like this final question. Colin in Mobile, Alabama, wants to know, as someone talking about you who lives in the Gulf Coast, can you talk about how much of a monumental shift it is to have Mobile being represented by a Democrat?
Well, yeah, I guess the city of Mobile is interesting, but, you know, it's probably there's a large, you know, black population there, and it's pretty, you know, a lot of college-educated people. They got an Airbus down there. I'm getting ready to go to Point Clear here in a little over a week, which is a great place at that Grand Hotel. People don't realize what a gorgeous place that the Alabama, Mobile area and that whole Gulf area is. I don't even go to Gulf Shores anymore. My brother has a place there. It's too crowded. But I always love going to Point Clear, and it's Baldwin County, I think, and it's good. And Mobile's a nice town. It's very similar to New Orleans in many ways, and most people don't realize that.
Well, keep those letters coming. If we didn't get to yours this week, emails or letters, please send it again. We'll try to get to it next week because they are so interesting and really stimulating and provocative. We love our listeners. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Real Paper and ExpressVPN, and our episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.